This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a Central Coast city that is hoping to cash in on a billion-dollar-plus tech economy.
We want to be able to use the drone technology as a really quick way to spot problems before they become bigger problems.
And later, what's the economic hit San Luis Obispo County will take when the Diablo Canyon power plant closes? According to a new study, it may be less than previously thought.
The plant isn't going to close in a vacuum. It's not all of a sudden just going to turn off the switch one day and everyone will move away.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It is Monday, July 15th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's summertime and temperatures are warming across the Central Coast, and small wildland fires have been breaking out in our counties, especially on windier days. And small to medium-sized earthquakes continue to shake Kern County. So whether it's an earthquake, wildfire, or flood, will you be notified if a disaster is heading your way? Many people who fled last year's campfire did not receive emergency alerts. Capital Public Radio's Bob Moffett looks at what happened on the morning of November 8th in Paradise and Butte County, and how other communities are responding as we enter this year's fire season.
The fire's about to jump out.
The speed of the campfire took everyone, including first responders, by surprise the morning of November 8th.
Paradise, multiple structures on fire near 97.
The fire traveled 8 miles in 70 minutes from a remote area of Butte County to the town of Paradise. Gloria Wright lived there.
The flames were 75 feet in the air coming at us, so you only had about 6 minutes to get out of there. So there wasn't any warning system.
But there was a warning system. The question is, did it work? Butte County Incident Commanders ordered 8 emergency alerts in the first 3.5 hours of the fire. There were delays. The County Emergency Communications Center took about 15 minutes to enter each of its early orders into its Code Red computer system, which then sent robocalls, texts, and emails. Cal Fire Division Chief John Messina was one of the incident commanders.
That is not unreasonable. There's just always a reflex time in any order you give in any type of operation.
But then the delays grew to 30, then 40 minutes. Code Red logs show no notifications were sent to the western neighborhoods of Paradise. There were also communication problems.
Paradise Police, how can I help you?
Butte County didn't tell Paradise Police dispatchers for 15 minutes that part of the town was under evacuation.
What says that?
Residents who called 911 did.
Butte, fire. Okay, we haven't been advised of that.
Messina issued the first evacuation order for Paradise at 7:44, but Paradise Town Hall didn't issue its until an hour later. Almost all of the numbers that Paradise then called had already been notified by Butte County. Emergency alerts from the county failed to reach more than 5,400 of the 15,000 numbers called. Of those that did go through, a little more than half were actually answered by a person, the rest by voicemail. Butte County sent 5,900 texts and emails. There's no way to know how many people saw them in time. Often neighbors and first responders were the alert system.
It is time to go, gentlemen. It's time to go.
There were also phone outages. Verizon says all but one of its 14 towers survived the fire, but third-party fiber optic cables did not. Other fire-prone communities have made changes as they eye a new fire season. Placer, Sacramento, and Yolo counties respond to emergencies as one entity. They use an alert system called Everbridge that helps them communicate to the public. Placer dispatcher Rachel Cleveland says a previous system was woefully ineffective.
It dialed like one person at a time. So you'd like start with school notifications for a snow day at 6 a.m. and at 10:15 it would finish.
She says it now takes 90 seconds to enter an order and send it to the public using any available call centers in the three counties. Farther south, Christy Mitchell with the Mariposa County Sheriff's Office says improvements to phone reception have been a priority.
AT&T brought in some generator-powered towers and put them around the county to increase cell service during the Detweiler fire. Since then, we've worked with Verizon, working in the River Canyon because of the Ferguson fire.
Over in Lake County, residents in remote areas came up with $100,000 and bought 4 sirens that can be sounded by the sheriff using a radio transmitter. But they're just sirens. People still must call or go online to find out what's happening. Another notification method is the Federal Wireless Emergency Alert System, or WEA, which can send one message to an entire county. But 16 counties don't have access to it, and incident commanders are reluctant to use it for fear of over-notification. Changes to WEA this year should allow longer and more targeted messages. The state of California has issued non-binding guidelines for emergency alerts and communications. Cities and counties don't agree on everything, but they do seem to share a single goal: get as many people signed up for alerts as possible, then hope people receive them. As we've seen in Paradise, there are no guarantees. I'm Bob Moffitt in Sacramento.
You can see the complete investigation report at capradio.org. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. The global commercial drone market is valued at $1.6 billion and growing quickly. Communities around the world, including the Monterey Bay area, are trying to get a piece of that economic growth. Erica Mahoney from member station KAZU brings us this story.
Drones buzz over open space on the former Fort Ordon Marina. About 35 people are practicing takeoffs and landings. This is Drone Camp, hosted by the University of California.
Yeah, left hand down and perfect.
Maggie Kelly helps a camper land her drone. Kelly runs the training on drones, or UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles.
That's what this drone camp is all about, is providing all of these folks the basic background to incorporate UAVs into their workflows.
Launching.
Campers include educators, researchers, and people like Michael Mattson. He's a scientist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He's currently monitoring disease in a local strawberry field.
So we want to be able to use the drone technology as a really quick way to spot problems before they become bigger problems.
Mattson says it's much faster than checking on foot. He sees drones as a valuable tool for all kinds of crops in the Salinas Valley. That future is what's behind Monterey Bay DART. It's an initiative to create a local hub for drone, automation, and robotics technology, DART. Josh Metz helped create Monterey Bay DART. He says it's compatible not just with agriculture, but other economic engines of this region.
Conservation and natural resources management, certainly the national defense and homeland security applications and public safety are significant.
Metz is the economic development manager for the Fort Ord Reuse Authority. The agency oversees economic recovery of the former Fort Ord Army base following its closure nearly 25 years ago. Metz says a drone and robotics hub could be in Marina. Right next to the Army's old airport, now the Marina Airport, is the UC MBES Center. It was supposed to be a research and development center, but it never materialized.
Due to a combination of factors, perhaps most significantly the Great Recession, this project area has yet to realize the dreamed of 4,000 to 6,000 high-quality jobs that it was originally envisioned for.
So it's already prepped for development, with high-speed internet and lighting along the roads. Metz walks outside and points to acres of open space that could be used for drone testing. He also thinks the area's proximity to Silicon Valley is a big plus.
Boy, nothing but opportunity in front of us.
I think Marina is really starting to hit its stride in terms of maturing and growing, and it's exciting to be a part of that.
Jeff Creshrew manages the Marina Municipal Airport. As he watches a plane land, he says the airport isn't realizing its full potential. He says future plans for the airport include expanding the business park. The Bonny Doon-based company, Joby Aviation, is already leasing 2 buildings and in talks with the city of Marina about adding a future manufacturing facility. Joby Aviation is developing drone-inspired air taxis. They're being designed for commuters.
They would be our most significant tenant to date in terms of potential jobs. And so we're very excited about that. But even more so, this is a nice segue into the discussion of drone and robotics and what they call the UAS market.
That global market is expected to reach over $12 billion in value by 2025. That's according to market research firm Tractica. Other West Coast communities already working in the drone space include San Diego, Reno, and Grand Forks, North Dakota. In Marina, Erica Mahoney, KAZU News.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. While we're up in Monterey County, KCBX correspondent Tom Wilmer recently attended the change of command ceremony at Army Reserve Garrison Fort Hunter Liggett. He spoke with the outgoing commander, Colonel Kerry Norman, and incoming commander, Colonel Charles Bell.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett in Monterey County. We're here with Colonel Kerry Norman, commander of the base. Hi, Kerry.
How you doing, Tom? It's great to see you today.
You too. This is kind of a sad day for me because change of command, and you're going to Fort Leonard Wood?
I am. You think it's a sad day for you. It's a sad day for me to leave this beautiful installation.
Major shift in your life, isn't it?
Oh, yes, very much so, because every time you take command and then you leave command, you never know if you're going to be afforded that gift again, because it is truly a gift and an honor when you're given command.
Going back in time, you started out in San Francisco at the Presidio, didn't you?
I did,
yes. As an enlisted private in the MPs?
Yep, I sure did. I started in 1986 and got my commission in 1992 at what was then 6th Army, which no longer exists at the Presidio. It's kind of neat to come back to California and be able to command here.
And how long have you been base commander at Fort Hunter Liggett?
Every commander is given 2 years. It's a 2-year tenure because you are board selected to do this.
During your time here, last 2 years, you've gone through some amazing training exercises and some hurdles, I'm sure. What are some of the most outstanding memories that you think of?
Oh, definitely bringing back major training and achieving our joint qualification as an installation. As you know, we're the 7th largest installation in the Army, and a lot of people don't know that. We have about 170,000 acres.
And are you number one training base for the Army Reserve?
We are definitely that. So when we had the 7th ID come back with their strikers and train here, and that was just absolutely wonderful. Commanding General really credited us when they went to National Training Center for getting as many T's. They got 5 T's out of 6, which means they were trained in 5 areas, and he directly accredits that to being here at Hunter Liggett training.
During these training exercises, you have as many as, what, 8,000, 9,000 troops here?
Well, actually, we've had up to 12.
Wow.
Last year we had 12, but we pass through probably about 70,000 to 80,000 on average a year that we train, and that's Army, Air Force, Marines, Navy, some police departments, three-letter agencies, British, Canadians, you name it. Everybody's coming here.
And right now, today, on basis, the mobile medic exercise is still going on.
Global medic, yep, global medic. So they've been doing a great job too, and testing all their skills. And
they set up mass units.
They do, yes. They set up a mobile hospital. They have just been wonderful. Great, great folks here.
Did they do actual medevac exercises, loading
and
helos?
They had what we call some dust-off helicopters. If you see the ones with the Red Cross on them, those are the dust-offs, and so they did all of that. And then also our fire department and police also assisted in some of that as well.
Going forward in Colonel Norman's life, you're going to Fort Leonard Wood?
Yes, everybody always wanted to get that and Fort Leavenworth confused, and they're actually only a couple states away or a state away. I'm going to be the Deputy Commandant of the Military Police School, which is great, and I look forward to that. I'll play a big part in the external training, the reserve forces outside of Leonard Wood, which we train them here as well. We train MPs here at Fort Hunter Liggett, and also be on the command staff and be part of policy making and regulations for the Military Police Corps, as well as also interacting with the young MPs, whether they're enlisted or officers at the schoolhouse.
And where is Fort Leonard Wood?
Fort Leonard Wood is in Missouri, and I would say it's closer to Springfield, but it's along the Turnpike 44, the Will Rogers Turnpike, and it's about an hour north of Springfield.
Reeling back in time, before you came to Hunter Liggett, as I remember, you were at Fort McCoy in Wisconsin, is that correct?
Actually, that was a couple of jobs ago. Before I came here, I was at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, where I worked for the 104th. Before that, I was a professor of military science at Seattle University. So McCoy was before my battalion command at Knox, but yes, I was there as a major. I was at McCoy.
When you were teaching, what were you teaching?
When I was at Seattle University, I taught mostly the seniors before they got commissioned.
So these are ROTC?
Yes, ROTC. And it's funny because I still hear from my lieutenant, well, they were my cadets, but now they're all lieutenants, and some are getting close to captainhood. So it's wonderful to still hear from them.
Parting thoughts.
Wow, there's been a lot of changes. We assisted King City in getting an Amtrak stop, which is going to be a big deal. I'd like the public to know that we have a lot of facilities here that they can use. We've started steak night again at the Hacienda, the historic Hearst Hacienda. So I recommend people look at the Fort Hunter Liggett Morale Welfare Recreation Facebook page, and you can see things that are going on. And it's just been the greatest honor to be the commander here.
Well, it's my honor.
Thank you so much. You are the best. I really enjoy visiting with you.
You too. I'm Tom Willmer reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett in Monterey County, where we've been talking with Colonel Kerry Norman, base commander. Thanks.
Thanks. Good?
Yeah. I'm Tom Willmer reporting from Hunter Liggett Army Reserve Base in Monterey County. Right now we're with Colonel Charles Bell. This is a special day. You're taking command today, aren't you?
Yes, sir. Taking command of the Fort Hunter Liggett Garrison.
Where was your last duty station?
My last duty station, I was the operations officer for readiness at the 412th Theater Engineer Command in Vicksburg, Mississippi.
So this is a change, even geographically, right?
This is a big change, but there are a lot of similarities in terms of, you know, how we can affect training here at Fort Hunter Liggett.
Looking forward, what's overarching in your mind, your biggest challenge, the thing that you want to get your teeth into right away?
I think, you know, as I look at the garrison, I think about the training and how we can affect the readiness of our soldiers as they come out here and what we can do to support them. And that's, I don't know if it's a challenge, but it's definitely a goal of mine. I want to make sure that every soldier that comes out here is fully equipped to come out here and do the training that our commanders need so that they're trained and ready.
You have exercises right now that you're going to jump into, right? There's Global Medic going on.
Yes, sir. So we have Global Medic going on, and then as we roll into next year, I know we're lined for a combined support training exercise, as well as some construction exercises. We have the gamut of functional as well as collective exercises.
It's June right now, going into the summer and fall. Do you have more exercises plan?
I think Global Medic kind of closes the door for our exercises this fiscal year, but as we head into October and November, we'll start to see a rotation of CBs come in and do construction, followed by several other rotations.
Mm-hmm. And a little bit about you and your background. You went to university majoring in what?
Yeah, so I am a graduate from Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, and I have a business degree. I'm an engineer by trade, but not by degree. I've been fortunate to work in the engineer profession my entire career. So that's my degree. I've also...
Were you ROTC in school?
I was. I was ROTC in school. And then I was able to go to the Army War College. And of course, I have a master's degree from the Army War College.
You're in the Army Reserves. When did that start?
Yeah, so I'm in the Army Reserve. That started about 1991. And so I was an enlisted soldier for some time. And then I went through ROTC and commissioned in 1997. So I've been a commissioned officer since 1997. Mm-hmm. And then following that, in around 2001, I came in the AGR program. I'm active duty in support of the Guard and Army Reserve.
AGR meaning?
Active Guard.
A lot of people don't know you also have, you're interconnected with Camp Parks way up in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Camp Parks is one of our subordinate installations, Dublin, California. So those are our subordinate installations. I'm looking forward to getting up to Camp Parks.
And how do you guys work together? What's the relationship?
Camp Parks is like a subordinate command. They have, of course, their own garrison commander and Lieutenant Colonel Jennifer Nolan and Command Sergeant Major Johnson. But when they need support, they reach back to us as kind of the bigger command, and we provide that support.
How long have you been here?
I've been here for 2 weeks.
So you've got your feet on the ground. Going forward, what's one of the things that you plan to work on, to change, to modify, to enhance?
I think, like we spoke about earlier, the big thing that I plan to work on is really ensuring that we have the support plans in place to support units that come in to train. That's why we're here. We're predominantly a training installation. That's key for us, and I want to make sure that everything's set up so that the units are successful when they come here to train.
Colonel Charles Bell, what a pleasure to meet you, and I look forward to working with you in the future.
Yes, sir. Thank you for the interview. I appreciate you coming out and interviewing us and attending this change of command, so thank you.
My pleasure. I'm Tom Willmer, reporting Fort Hunter Liggett in Monterey County.
Hey, Tom. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Tyler Pratt. Practicing internet security, how to best manage apps, and understanding your privacy are all skills many of us deal with on a daily basis. But for some older internet users, there can still be a learning curve. KCBX contributor Beth Thornton spoke with a member of the American Association of Retired Persons to discuss technology trends for people 50 and over in the United States. In addition to top trends, they discuss how seniors can find educational resources to further participate and stay safe online. AARP's latest research focuses on tech-savvy grandparents.
This is Beth Thornton with KCBX Issues and Ideas. I'm talking with Patty David, Director of Consumer Insights for AARP, about the technology trends for people 50 and over in the United States. Hi, Patty. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with you telling us about the mission of the AARP and your role within the organization.
So AARP is a social mission organization, and we're all about making it possible for the older population, 50 and older, to age the way that they would want to age. As the Director of Consumer Insights, my role is to really bring that consumer vision and infuse it so that they understand how the 50-plus are thinking, behaving, their needs, their wants, and how they're exploring the world and how they'd like to age.
AARP has been around for a long time, and it's a place that millions of people look to for information and resources. How do you go about gathering information on older generations, and how do you decide what to study?
AARP is 60 years old this year, so pretty exciting, been around for a while. We have very specific areas that we're looking at that we want to impact and understand the impact that they have to their lives. Those things are around health, financial resilience, as well as, you know, kind of their personal fulfillment and their self perspective. And so we're looking at things that impact those areas.
I'm looking at your recently published top technology trends. One of the top trends is that seniors are using technology and social media for personal enrichment. Explain to us what that means.
A lot of people think that as the population ages, they're less likely to be inclined to use and engage with technology. And that's really not true. That's a myth that we like to bust over and over. You know, technology is pretty mainstream in their lives. You know, over 90% of them have a computer in their house. 83% of them are on a smartphone, which is pretty much at par with the U.S. population. And so they are used to this technology. They are learning it. They are understanding it. And they're using it to make sure that it can have an impact on their life and enrich it in ways that every part of the population is doing. They're using it to keep in touch with their family and friends, you know, using it to make their life easier, using it to learn, take classes, utilize different tutorials. So, you know, and some of them are doing their games on it. They're engaged with it just like the rest of the population is and really using it to make their life easier.
And are they using social media sites?
They're definitely using social media sites. The biggest site that they use is Facebook, but they're also engaged with Instagram and Twitter. They're using them on a daily basis.
When you're asking the question about personal enrichment, does that include reading the news online?
It includes gathering and getting information online, and that may include, you know, looking at it from the perspective of reading news or getting news pushed to them, as well as exploring different subject areas and stuff that they want to learn more about.
Is there a concern from your standpoint about seniors having the media literacy skills they need to determine credible information or to recognize false content online?
I think that, you know, our population, the 50-plus population, is always, you know, more likely to be more prevalent to fraud scams and become a victim. And so we're always looking at ways that we can help educate them and make sure that they're aware of what's going out there and what the tips and advice are and concrete steps that they can take to avoid it.
How do you go about sharing the information with seniors about credible information and staying safe online?
We offer a lot of in-person and online workshops. You can most certainly visit learn.arp.org for a listing of them. They're all over the U.S. in 38 markets. They're looking at different technology subject issues and stuff to help the older population understand and use their technology.
Let's look at some of the other top trends. Seniors are purchasing technology products, and they are showing a growing interest in smart technology like cars and TVs. I guess that's not at all surprising since those products make life easier. What did surprise me, though, was the statistic that only one in four adults 50 years or older trusts shopping online. It sounds like the seniors are interested in buying the technology, but not necessarily acquiring it online.
I would agree with that, but I think that comes down to just from the understanding of being safe and secure. So when you're talking about shopping online and actually doing a transaction and a purchase and using your credit card to do it, there's a lot of concerns that this population has around privacy and security. And I think that's where it aligns with the privacy and security. So yes, they definitely want to do things and make their life easier, but over top of that, they have to feel like they're secure in doing it. And so that's where it really comes in with the education, so that we're really giving them the education that they need to understand security and privacy, and so they can have confidence in being able to do the things that they want to do online.
Let's turn for a minute to grandparents. Tell us about your report titled Tech and Modern Grandparents.
We just finished doing a grandparenting study the end of last year, which was really an in-depth study to look at that very specific population of grandparents. And grandparents have a lot of influences that are happening to them, and a lot of things that are based on life events or life situations that really are driving them to use different technology. You know, they're highly, highly engaged or want to be engaged with their grandchildren, but yet they live so far away from them. And so how do they then build that relationship and connect with them? And a lot of them are turning to technology to be able to do that as a connector. And they're connecting on frequent basis, and they're out of the box. It's not just talking on the phone. They're texting and video chatting and doing things through Facebook. And they're six times more likely to use a social media platform. Technology becomes that mechanism to make sure that they can see and relate and connect to their grandchild.
44% of grandparents describe themselves as tech savvy,
which
yes, is a pretty good number.
Very good number.
Staying connected to grandchildren might help to combat loneliness.
Well, that's the goal, to be able to have that connection to be able to combat it. I think the biggest thing that combats the loneliness is the ability to do more of the in-person things. But the nice thing is that technology allows those in-person things to be richer, because they see each other doing Facebook and FaceTime and video chatting and stuff, so that when they come together, that there's more of an engagement and a recognition, and so they can get a lot more highly engaged when they're doing things in person. So we know that, you know, our data shows that grandparents that have that connection in person with their grandchildren are less likely to be lonely. But, you know, the idea is that technology is helping for that connection to happen faster and quicker when they get those in-person time together.
Are there any other thoughts you can share on seniors and technology use?
It's there for them. They're actively taking advantage of it. They're looking for new and different ways that they can engage and use it. And, you know, the other emerging technologies like voice and virtual reality are starting to really take off in that market, albeit a little bit slower than the other age groups. But year over year, the growth is showing to be a bigger growth.
Thank you, Patty, for talking with me and sharing this information.
Not a problem. I totally enjoy it. I love talking about our information.
That was Patty David, Director of Consumer Insights for AARP in Washington, D.C. I'm Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. We're going to take a short break. When we return, there's a spacecraft currently in orbit above Earth, and it's about to set sail.
If we have a spacecraft that's low enough mass and big and reflective enough, then photons can give it a little push. Each photon imparts just a tiny bit of momentum, but the sun pumps out billions and billions of them every second.
Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo is serving as mission control. This story and more when we return on Issues and Ideas. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. In 2016, when the news that the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant would close, many in the surrounding communities panicked. Suddenly, the future of San Luis Obispo County looked uncertain. For 50 years, the region has relied on the plant for high-paying jobs and tax revenues from its operation that have helped support local schools and other government programs. The initial estimates were that the San Luis Obispo area would lose about $1 billion a year for several years following the closure. However, a new study out from a team of UC Berkeley economists says the negative economic impacts of the closure could be much less than previously predicted. Here's a conversation with Drew Banky, one of the economists who worked on the study, with host of KCRW podcast The 805's Jonathan Bastian.
We've heard a lot of different numbers about what the potential impact of closing Diablo Canyon could be. Some say, you know, it could be $1 billion a year. Others have that number as a bit smaller. After all the research you did, what is going to be the economic impact of closing this major site?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, the reason that the numbers vary so much is it's a forecasting exercise. So we're looking ahead into the future. And to be frank, we don't know the exact impact. And so what we did, our work is a bounding exercise. And so we sort of try to look at the upper bound of the worst case scenario and sort of the lower bound with the best case scenario.
Yeah.
The $1 billion estimate that sort of has been floating around, that was looking at the scenario where the plant closes completely and there are no offsetting decommissioning expenditures. Our study considers the additional expenditures that will happen when the plant decommissions, and that's why we find a slightly smaller effect.
So if you were to kind of look at, let's just look at a somewhat worst case scenario, what kind of a number would you throw out there?
It's hard to say. So, I mean, our study looks at it in different parts. So we consider, okay, what is the effect when the plant itself closes in its entirety?
Yeah.
We find about an $800 million loss to the local regional economy of San Luis Obispo. And we find about 4,000 jobs that will be lost. That would be the worst case scenario, but we are very confident that that's not going to be the net impact. There's a few reasons, actually. The first is there are additional funds that are being spent right now, thanks to Senate Bill 1090, which is capitalizing additional funds for retention and retraining and some other stimulus spending. And so that's going into the economy already in advance. But the main reason is the plant isn't going to close in a vacuum. It's not all of a sudden just going to turn off the switch one day and everyone will move away.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of decommissioning expenditures and jobs to get the plant safely offline. And so, yeah, when we consider those effects, we find a much, much smaller net impact. We find that the decommissioning expenditures themselves, depending on how we look at it, we model it over 10 years, but will increase output by about $723 million. So that would be a net loss of $77 million.
Okay. So it sounds like between the state, potentially doing retraining or providing certain funds, as well as the kind of timeline of winding this thing down, and the fact that there's still going to be a number of folks needed to actually decommission this thing, that, as you mentioned, it's not like suddenly the lights go off. But, you know, these are very high-paying jobs at Diablo Canyon. And I wonder, you know, when we look 10 to 20 years down the line, will those folks that worked at the plant, do you get a sense that they will be able to kind of transition into other industries that might come online? Because what could really take the place of something as big as Diablo Canyon?
That is a good point, and it's a concern that we've heard from local stakeholders. I think, realistically, a lot of folks who are able to will retire and stay in the area. Other people will likely have to move out. That being said, you know, we find that the net impact, there's going to be more jobs actually entering the economy from the decommissioning expenditures. We find about 5,000 new jobs being created annually for decommissioning. So that's a net gain in employment of about 2,000 jobs overall.
They're going to need people to simply close the plant. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. They're going to have to hire sort of, you know, people to come close the plant. And there's going to be more people needed to come do that than the amount of people who operate the plant. We look at sort of what is the effect of these additional people coming into the economy and the spending that they do. So there has been some concern that the people, you know, decommissioning a nuclear power plant is a very specialized task. So very likely these people will come from outside of the community. However, their dollars will stay within the community. So this is going to be a long project. Sometimes they can take, you know, 20 plus years. And we find a gain in local jobs. And these are, you know, service sector jobs that can't be outsourced, that have to come from local constituents. But the issue is salaries. So these are, the average salary at Diablo Canyon is a high paying job, and they will be replaced in some sense by a lower paying job, albeit there will be more of them. So in some sense, we argue that it is a more inclusive economy. It allows for more employment at a more diversified level of income. And of course, this relates to housing costs, which is sort of the elephant in the room and something that we saw over and over again. Is where are these lower wage workers, where can they afford to live?
Right.
And I think that's a great question. And it's a question that is unrelated to Diablo Canyon. You know, speaking to local stakeholders, some of the biggest concerns were the ability for the San Luis Obispo economy to diversify and recruit new companies, new talent. And there's a housing crisis. There's an affordability gap. It is currently a middle income community with very high income housing costs.
Right. A lot of people like to imagine what could take the place of Diablo Canyon. Of course, at this point, nuclear energy is kind of seen as kind of the previous wave of energy development in the U.S. And there has been some reporting, even by the New York Times, that we could potentially see wind farms off the coast of Diablo Canyon because they have transmissions lines there and so on and so forth. I know this wasn't part necessarily of your research, but did this come up at all about how San Luis Obispo and the county at large could transform maybe into more of a green energy producing county?
Unfortunately, yeah, that was outside of the scope of our work. I do know that there is discussions of having some offshore wind, but it's still a big unknown, I think, what will be done with the site.
Finally, from an outsider's perspective, one could look at the closing of Diablo Canyon as catastrophic for the community. And sometimes you hear media reports of folks just being scared, local business owners being scared about the business they might lose. But after delivering your report in the community, do you feel that you were able to kind of give folks a different sense of what the future could be versus kind of what some would think of as just worst case scenarios?
Yeah, I think our results are slightly more encouraging than, you know, people were initially thinking. And in some ways, it can be thought of as a stimulus to the local economy, because although this plant is closing, there will be a lot of money spent safely getting it offline. The fact that this is so planned out and people are expecting it, I think, presents a bit more of an opportunity.
That's economist Drew Banky, who worked with a team of economists at Berkeley to look at the impacts of the Diablo Canyon decommissioning. Drew, thanks again for the time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Tyler Pratt here. In late June, a rocket blasted off from Florida's Kennedy Space Center, and its payload was a unique spacecraft, decades in the making. And San Luis Obispo's Cal Poly is serving as mission control. First, we'll hear a segment produced by KCBX's Greta Mart to introduce the spacecraft. Then Greta sits down in the KCBX studio with mission project manager Bruce Betts of the Planetary Society.
My next guest.
If you're old enough to have been a Johnny Carson fan, you may recall a 1976 interview on his late-night talk show with the famous astronomer
Dr. Carl Sagan.
In that interview, Sagan introduced America to a novel idea.
Let's talk about this. This is interesting.
Well, there's a just tremendously exciting prospect called solar sailing. And which travels on the radiation and particles that come out of the sun, the wind from the sun.
43 years later, the concept is now a reality, and it's crowdfunded. It's called LightSail 2, and it just got dropped off into Earth's orbit by a SpaceX delivery rocket. The team running the LightSail 2 operation are now at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo. That's home of mission control for the project. Today, they will unleash the spacecraft from its carrying case. Once they confirm everything's working properly, the team will command the craft to unfurl its solar panels and sails. Then it'll orbit the Earth, propelled only by sunlight. Here's astronomer Bill Nye explaining how it works in a Planetary Society video.
Light is made up of particles we call photons. So imagine this ping pong ball is a photon, a single particle of light. Now, photons weigh nothing. They have no mass, but they still have momentum. If we have a spacecraft that's low enough mass and big and reflective enough, then photons can give it a little push. Each photon imparts just a tiny bit of momentum, but the sun pumps out billions and billions of them every second.
Bill Nye is CEO of the Planetary Society, which was co-founded by Carl Sagan. The Planetary Society is an international nonprofit that advocates for space exploration, the world's largest non-governmental space organization. From its members and people around the world giving donations, it crowdsourced the funding to pay for the LightSail 2 mission. Mark Boyin is with the Planetary Society.
For us, since we're funded by citizens, you know, we'd like to say we're democratizing space.
Boyin says the goal of the mission is to prove solar sailing is a viable means to travel through space.
Because you don't have to bring up fuel. And that's like one of the hardest things about a spacecraft. You go up into space and you have to bring this fuel to get around, and it either will run out at some point or be very just heavy to get off of the ground. And this helps solve that problem.
KCBX News interviewed Boyin last year at Cal Poly when LightSail 2 was first packed into its cosmic suitcase called a CubeSat. And now the concept Carl Sagan first described in the 1970s is about to power a spacecraft into higher and higher orbit. As Bill Nye says, if the mission is a success, the descendants of LightSail 2 may someday travel to the stars, fueled by the sun. Reporting in San Luis Obispo, I'm Greta Mart with KCBX News.
Bruce Betts has spent the past 18 years with the Planetary Society. He is chief scientist and LightSail 2 project manager, and visited the KCBX studio as the mission control team was gearing up to unfurl LightSail 2's solar panels and sails. That was scheduled to happen around July 7th, but the team encountered some glitches, so now the solar sail deployment is slated to take place around July 21st. Here's Greta Mart speaking with Bruce Betts.
Let me start with what we're doing now, which is we're each day, every time we get a tracking pass when the spacecraft passes over Cal Poly San Luis Obispo or one of our other tracking stations, including Georgia Tech and Purdue, we try to send commands and receive data from the spacecraft, which we've been doing, and we're checking out the spacecraft, making sure things are working right and establishing that going one step at a time, and we'll continue to do that. And then if all is well, then we will open up the solar panels. So the spacecraft is roughly the size of a loaf of bread. And on the side of the sides of it open up in order to allow the sail out. And also it exposes our two cameras to take pictures. We'll then check the spacecraft out again, make sure we're happy with it, and we will deploy the sail. So that's a roughly 3-minute process where the booms, four booms made of metal, kind of like tape measures, will pull the four triangular mylar sails out. And that works well. We'll start going into an actual solar sailing mode using light pressure to change the orbit of the spacecraft.
Okay, what's propelling it right now?
Right now it's just in an orbit around the Earth, so the rocket put it into that orbit, and it's just like the space station or anything else in orbit. It's keeping its velocity because there's nothing or very little to slow it down.
Alrighty, and so once the solar panels open, what are those for?
So we have solar cells just like you would, similar to what you would have to power a house or a car. And we use that to generate electricity and to charge the batteries to run the computer and run the communications and the radio. Those are on the outside and the inside of these panels. Why we really need to get the panels open is because that enables us to unfurl the sail. So they're getting out of the way of the sail deployment. And also they deploy two cameras on the ends of the panels, which have fisheye lenses and will take images and pictures of space and the Earth, but significantly of the sail and the sail deployment so we can evaluate it.
What happens when it goes in shadow, you know, behind the Earth? Explain how that works. How does it
work? Good question. So it indeed goes and enters the shadow of the Earth for a period of minutes on most orbits. And during that period, we're not generating electricity from the solar cells, and we're not getting any solar light pressure propulsion. But it picks up again. Both of those pick up again as soon as we're back into the sun. So it's just a temporary delay each time it enters shadow.
So once something's already in orbit, it just keeps going? How does that work?
It just stays in orbit. It's kind of like if you... Well, what we're not used to on Earth is that you have essentially no atmosphere there. So there's very little friction to slow it down. So once you're in space at a velocity, you stay at that velocity. Now, it's not quite true, and that'll come up later in our mission, because even at 720 kilometers altitude, there's still a few molecules of atmosphere. So very slowly, the orbit will get slowed down. It'll get dragged back into the atmosphere. But short of that, it just continues at roughly the same speed.
It's going to be up there for about a year.
Yeah, and that's a very imprecise estimate, but approximately a year. It's hard to predict because of the uncertainties of the spacecraft orientation, but also even the atmosphere of the Earth, because depending on solar storms, the atmosphere of the Earth will swell or shrink, and so you get more or less friction. But ballpark, a year.
And then, so it's not going to turn into space junk. The whole thing will burn up.
Yeah, the whole thing will burn up. It's not large enough to make it down to the surface of the Earth. When it hits the atmosphere doing 17,500 miles per hour, that will generate plenty of friction to heat and melt and vaporize everything.
Wow, okay. Let's back up. So when, for you personally, when was the first time you heard of this concept? Were you watching that Carl Sagan, Johnny Carson episode?
Not that I recall.
Okay.
I may have been. I heard about it certainly in graduate school where I was studying planetary science. And people talked about it. I heard about it. JPL had considered doing solar sails for the Halley Comet flyby in 1986, but then they were deemed impractical, particularly the sizes they were looking at. And so then when I came to the Planetary Society, it was already a very active concept in trying to fly a solar sail mission.
So what's different now than in the 80s? Why it was impractical then, but it's practical now?
The technology has changed, and so it just is with our computers and our phones. It's miniaturized. And the key for solar sailing is the area of your sail. You want it that big, and you want the mass, the weight of your spacecraft to be small. And so the advent of particularly what we're testing out, CubeSats, which was pioneered at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo as well as elsewhere, the advent of these low-cost, standardized, small spacecraft is something that motivated us to see if you could use that for solar sailing. Because right now, CubeSats, small spacecraft, are very common in Earth orbit and used by universities and agencies, all sorts of entities. But there isn't much use in interplanetary space. Part of the restriction is you have a small spacecraft, you can't carry very much fuel. So what if you could put a propulsion method in a CubeSat that would enable you to not have to use fuel? And that's largely what we're testing out, that we can do controlled solar sailing with a very small spacecraft.
Okay, got it. And this one, LightSail 2, just stays in our orbit, in our atmosphere, or just outside the atmosphere?
The atmosphere has no hard cutoff, so it's outside most of the atmosphere, but there's still a little tiny bit left.
I guess the goal is to prove that solar sailing is a viable method to travel in space. Let's say another mission went up and it kept going outward into space. I mean, eventually, wouldn't it would stop because it would not have any more sunlight? I mean, or how does that work?
So if one sends a spacecraft out and you're clear of Earth's gravity and you keep going, yes, indeed, your spacecraft will get far enough from the sun that you will have very little effect of sunlight. But again, because you're in space and there's hardly any atmosphere, there's essentially nothing there, it won't slow down. It will actually continue to accelerate a little bit from what little sunlight you have. But indeed, the best places to use solar sails are in the inner solar system where you have more sunlight, or someday using lasers to actually push on the spacecraft to accelerate them to high speeds to go farther.
That was KCBX's Greta Mart speaking with Bruce Betts of the Planetary Society. You can keep up with the latest on the LightSail 2 mission at www.planetary.org. Issues and Ideas was on break last week following the July 4th holiday. Before we go today, let's revisit Independence Day in 1776 in California. The 13 colonies were busting loose. It would be 75 more years before folks along the eastern seaboard would even hear of California. But it was there all along and well populated. California had colonies too. In this episode from new podcast Up the Road from North State Public Radio, they ask what was it like to live in California on July 4th, 1776? Depends on who you were and where.
This is Up the Road, dedicated to sustaining the California story. I'm Kim Weir. July 4th, 1776, the first and original Independence Day for these United States. Stars and Stripes, Liberty Bell, George Washington, with or without cherry tree. Fifes and drums, rat-a-tat-tat, smoking muskets, fireworks, the rocket's red glare. Those 13 colonies finally busting loose. It would be almost 75 years, the California Gold Rush, before anyone on the eastern seaboard gave a thought to the continent's western coast, if there even was a coast over there. What was it like to live in California on July 4th, 1776? Depends on who you were and where. If you were a local, meaning among the people here at least 10,000 years, let's call them native Californians, in most places life went on much as always, and such an abundant life. So rich was the land that about one-third of all Native Americans in what we now recognize as the U.S. lived here in California. Up to 300,000 people organized into distinct communities or bands. Thanks to their industry, this was no untouched wilderness. They used fire, selective harvests, and other practices to encourage useful plants and animals and to discourage infestations of insects and disease and the catastrophic fires that plague the state today. In early contact with explorers and missionaries, most Californians were described as quick-witted, gracious, and generous. But that contact with Europeans and later Americans, more explorers and missionaries, hunters and trappers, settlers, gold seekers, would devastate these first residents who had no immunity to diseases the newcomers brought. The Spanish were the first newcomers to settle in. They were here in California on July 4, 1776, U.S. Independence Day. Though barely, dependent on unpredictable supply ships, struggling to feed and house themselves, they rarely traveled inland. But the diseases they brought with them traveled far and fast. Well before the California Gold Rush of 1849, much of Native California had died of pestilence, women and children the hardest hit. Other facts about the Spanish here are still disputed, largely because historical archives were destroyed in the San Francisco earthquake and fire of 1906. But thanks to historian Leon G. Campbell, we know, as he says, in 1774, the same year that Bostonians resisted the intolerable acts of the English government, Spanish authorities in Mexico dispatched Captain Juan Bautista de Anza from the Tubac Presidio south of Tucson to blaze a trail overland to Alta California. De Anza reached Monterey in the spring of 1774. The following year, on his second expedition, he pushed further north to the Bay of San Francisco, and shortly after the Americans penned their Declaration of Independence, the Mission and Presidio of San Francisco were founded on September 17, 1776. With this established, the Crown decreed the following year that the capital of the Californias should be transferred from Loreto and Baja to Monterey. As a P.S., Monterey's mission and presidio were already there, established in 1770, and a small pueblo. In fact, Sebastian Vizcaino entered Monterey Bay in 1602, 18 years before the pilgrims arrived at Plymouth Rock, please note. Next time you're in Monterey, visit the impressive period buildings that still survive from its days as California's first capital. Until next time, when we answer the question, why travel? This is Kim Weir for Up the Road.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.